everything right. Come home, build your life, go to work, love your family, and still have something that you're carrying inside that just won't leave you alone. Some wounds hit your body, some the mind, others hit part of you that decides what kind of man that you're going to be. That's where a lot of veterans get stuck, especially when their mission forced choices that still feel impossible years later. This conversation today gives language to that fight and a path through the impossible feeling that it brings about. Dr. Edward Tick, our guest today, breaks down moral injury in a way that's honest, clear, and grounded in decades of work with combat veterans. He gets into why some pain keeps growing in silence, why service and atonement matter, why healing has to involve community, and why telling the story out loud can change everything for some folks. But before we get into this episode, I want to take a moment to raise awareness for something that's deeply important to our community, the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. This organization is working to build a permanent national memorial in Washington, D.C. to honor the service members, families, and civilians who were impacted by the Global War on Terrorism. This memorial will be both a tribute to those who have served and a way to ensure that their sacrifices are recognized and remembered for generations to come. If you'd like to learn more or find out how you can support their mission, visit GWATMemorialFoundation.org. Hey, Ed, welcome to the show. Really glad to have you here.
Thank you, Scott. Honored to be with you. Thanks for having
me. Yeah, you bet. Absolutely. Before we jump into the conversation, I know you and I had been talking just a little bit here before we started recording, and we already started to get into kind of a flow here, but I don't want to jump right into the conversation quite yet. Could you just give us a little background on who you are, introduce yourself, that type of thing, just for the listeners who may not be familiar with you, just to kind of set the stage for who it is that we're talking with here?
Sure. Well, thank you for the invitation.
Sure. Absolutely.
To be here and to introduce myself. So I'm older than I look, folks. I turned 75 next week. So I am the Vietnam generation. And my long story briefly is, it began in childhood. My father had PTSD. My grandparents were refugees from the pogroms in Eastern Europe. So they came with PTSD. My father had PTSD from his childhood and from his military experience. My godfather, my mother's only sibling, was an older brother who was a medic at the Battle of the Bulge. And he didn't have PTSD. They didn't call it that then, but he really had what in World War I was called shell shock. He shook and could barely talk for the rest of his life, even though he lived into his 80s. And he was my godfather, so I absorbed him, though he couldn't talk to anybody, but even standing next to him, you know, I knew I was with the living dead. So yeah. That's in my background. I turned 18 in 1969, the height of the Vietnam War. I began protesting that war in college, in high school at about age 15. I'm not against the military, and I'm not against our warriors. We need them. And I love them. I love our warriors. What I'm against is the wrong or the immoral use of force in any time. And I was aware, though we didn't call it, I was aware that while Vietnam was going on, we were causing moral injury. And the people I knew who were coming back didn't really have what we call PTSD, but they had serious moral injury. Why did I go? It was wrong. I was killing innocent people. So I was witnessing moral injury and PTSD from my teenage years.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I was applying for conscientious objector, and I was willing to serve as a corpsman. And then during the Vietnam War, we had, when 1969, the lottery system for service was instituted. So I don't know if everybody knows what that was.
I'm familiar with it, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with it as well. And you know, we're fortunate enough these days that we don't have that sort of system in place it's all volunteer now, but it's different times.
All volunteer has profound problems as well. We can talk about
sure.
Universal. I actually believe in universal service, but not necessarily in the military. Universal service to give back to the country, and so that every one of us goes through a demanding rite of passage where we have to give back and we have to mature and we have to learn about the difficulties and challenges of being an adult so we can take our place. So I didn't have my rite of passage through military service in Vietnam because I got a high lottery number. I was working for CEO, willing to be a corpsman, and then I didn't have to do anything. And I'm going to own that for my entire generation. That's a moral injury. When you don't have to give anything back while other people are fighting and killing or being killed, and you don't have to take a stand, that really leaves a profound weakness and emptiness in the psyche.
I can definitely see that. And for the listeners who might have heard the small bit that you said that you kind of grew up and you're protesting the war and things like that. And for anyone who might be sitting there thinking like, oh man, this guy, he's not against, or he's not for the military and all this kind of stuff, even though you said that you were, I just want to kind of clear the air here, because the way this conversation started before we started recording was the exact opposite of that thought process. So coming out of you, it was respect, and it was, appreciation and all that for my service that was coming out of you. And it was, the same for all the other men and women out there. So I just wanted to clear the air there and make sure everyone is on the same page that I am anyways, because this is not one of those conversations where you're going to be, bashing the military and all that kind of stuff.
On the contrary, thank you for letting our friends out there know, because I am one of the best friends the military has on the planet. But they don't know that yet because we haven't gotten to that part of the story.
Sure, absolutely.
But thank you for letting everybody know. And this has been my life. Serving our military, who have served and sacrificed for us, has been my life's work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, and I'm in the brotherhood. And part of my message, I guess, is that we can earn our way into the brotherhood and sisterhood in other ways, not just directly through recognized military service. So I'm not a veteran technically, but I'm not a civilian either, because I've spent my life with veterans and serving veterans, and my own heart and psyche are full of military and war imagery and history. So I belong in our community and our brotherhood, sisterhood.
Yeah, and it's a big puzzle, and there's lots of pieces that go into the puzzle, and there are people who are on the civilian side and in the military, and all these people who need to come together to keep the wheels greased and keep the engine moving and all those kind of things, because it doesn't work with just any one person, and it takes a lot of people to be able to keep the wheels in motion for any number of, whether it's a conflict or even in peacetime. There's a lot of stuff that goes into it. And without people like yourself and other folks too, there's just no way that it keeps moving. So,
yeah.
So definitely.
So yeah. I build on what you just shared, that one of the biggest wounds, how shall we say this, unrecognized social wounds in our society is the terrible disconnect between the military and the civilian populations. Except
sure.
When families have people in the military, then they're in the military family. But the majority of people who aren't involved in the military don't know it, don't know what service takes and costs, and they haven't paid any dues themselves. They don't know. And it's critical that we grow toward a union of civilians and military into one shared audience of great concern and support.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Agree with how the military is being used. It's never right for civilians to turn against their military, even if they disagree with the mission. We still have to support. There are warriors. And what civilians must do is appreciate and support their warriors, because the warriors are there for them, even if they disagree with what's being done.
That's right. Yeah. And in the military, you follow orders. I mean, unless it's an illegal order, you follow those orders 100%. And you don't really have a choice. If they're going to send you to some foreign country and you have to go kick in doors and shoot the, you know, quote unquote bad guys or whatever, well, that's your job and you have to go do that. So, you know, it's again, part of what the country is asking you to do, and whether someone agrees with it or not, in some way, shape, or form, doesn't really matter, because those people who are doing it may not even agree with it, but they have to do it anyway. So, right. You know, now
that can,
you mentioned that.
Can I?
Oh, go ahead.
I can briefly.
Yeah.
We just built on it. I would like to circle back to my own story briefly, because.
Yeah.
Just shared something of what's behind it. So while in college, I got the high lottery number and I didn't have to serve. And I knew something was missing in me. I wanted to give and wanted to give support to the people serving. So flash forward, 1975, I graduated with my master's degree in psychology. I moved to a rural part of Central New York State. And I was invited into a medical practice to be the therapist there. So our beginning, you know, was, how old was I? I was in my mid-20s at the time. And some of the people who started to come into that early young practice when I was young and innocent were recently returned Vietnam veterans.
Okay.
Couple of things. One thing was people told me they're dangerous, they're crazy, don't work with them. Second thing is there was no literature training about it at all at the time. Third is there was no... The name of the wound, post-traumatic stress disorder, wasn't created until 1980. And I was with our vets like 5 years before that. Mm-hmm. And most importantly for me was I didn't have to serve in Vietnam during the war, but here are brothers coming in asking for help. Oh, I have the opportunity to be a home front doc. So
sure.
Back then in the mid 70s, when I began seeing veterans, I committed myself to doing the work, to running away from it, even though it was scary and we didn't know what we were doing. And I adopted the identity that I took my oath, my own spiritual oath, to grow into the identity of being the best home front doc for the invisible wounds that I possibly could learn how to be. So I took that now in 1970s, and I've been doing it ever since. And by now I'm considered one of the subject matter experts in the field. The chaplain corps, the Pentagon chose me The chief of chaplains of the U.S. Army stationed in the Pentagon chose me as the subject matter expert on moral injury and PTSD after my book War on the Soul came out. So I did serve that way in our military for a decade, and working all over the country and overseas, our military and veterans now for going on 50 years. So I've earned my place. And as I said earlier, I am in the brotherhood. Sometimes I'm called Doc, and I really glow with honor and pride and dignity, and feel like my life has been worthwhile serving all of you who make our collective lives worthwhile and safe.
Well, absolutely. And that's a great way to kind of, I guess, sum all this up is that, you know, it is an honor to be able to serve, whether it's you're serving your country in a uniform military capacity, or you're serving those who served in one way or another. And in your case, in a, you know, mental health field, and especially back then, where mental health was probably not to the extent that it is today, as advanced. You know, like you said, the phrase PTSD or that title for that diagnosis didn't even exist back then when you started. So things have come a long way. There's been a lot of progress in the field, and you know, being a part of that is probably pretty special as well. But I want to circle back to something that you had briefly mentioned kind of in the beginning of this episode, and that's the term moral injury, which some of our listeners are probably familiar with what that is, but maybe not everybody. Would you be able to give us a quick overview of what moral injury is and maybe an example or two?
Sure. So moral injury as defined as the impact on us psychologically and spiritually when we either participate in or witness any events that go against our most deeply held values. Mm-hmm. Basically, when we betray ourselves because we do something wrong, something sure. that we judge is wrong. So moral injury is a relatively new concept. It's only about 10 or 15 years in our modern nomenclature. So it's a new it's just been entered into the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. So people can be diagnosed as having moral injury. Now, moral injury presents very much like PTSD does. So we see many of the same symptoms, and the mental health field is still confused about what it is and how it presents in this way. Some people argue that PTSD and moral injury are very different. They're different wounds, and PTSD focuses more on the body and the central nervous system, and moral injury on the feelings and the spiritual dimensions. Some people believe that. Some people argue that no, they're really one and the same. Moral injury is in the core of PTSD. And that we are really a unified being, and our troubles can manifest in anywhere. Mind, mm-hmm. body, heart, spirit, community, all of those.
Sure.
Okay. So, and with full transparency, I am in the second school. I believe that moral injury is in the center of PTSD. I go way back with moral injury. Though we understand it as a modern diagnostic and mental health category, we had much earlier teachings about moral injury. Jesus taught us about moral injury. Socrates sure. taught us about moral injury. Yeah. Socrates, for example, said 2,400 years ago that the soul is the center of our existence. And the soul is that in us which distinguishes right and wrong, good and evil, and steers us toward the good and away from the evil. And we are hurting our souls if we do evil. Well, that's moral injury. And it was known in ancient times and recognized, and there are many, many practices for resolving moral injury around the world in all the world warrior traditions. We could look at the teachings of Jesus in the same way. Turn the other cheek. Sure. Don't harm the innocent. And also remember, in the temple at the money changers, Jesus really got angry. So even he once resorted to violence.
Sure. So it definitely has some... I think I agree with your analysis of moral injury and PTSD kind of being kind of combined, intertwined, if you will. There may be some instances where maybe that's not the case. Perhaps I can probably be convinced of that as well. But, you know, I think as far as the moral injury side of things goes, I wanted to bring that up because it is so new and there's a lot of it's been talked about a bunch lately. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that, you know, any of the listeners who might have heard it someplace else or just kind of stumbled across it, they had an idea of what it actually meant and what it, you know, how that might apply to their own situation, right. what they might be going through. And, you know, I always look at it as it's something that, like, you brought up religion with Jesus, and so I'll kind of continue with that. But, you know, a lot of Christians have the mindset of, you know, you shouldn't kill people. And then they go and join the military, and now they're being asked to go kill people. Yep. And then they do, and now there's a conflict there between what they've been taught all their life as a Christian, and then what they ended up doing. And now, well, okay, am I going to go to hell because I did this thing that was totally against all the teachings that I had, you know, growing up and all that. And it puts your mind in a conflicted state, because it one side, no, you're not supposed to ever do this. And the other side, I had to. If I didn't, I'd be dead. Right. And so, or somebody else might have been dead. So it's that inner conflict, that struggle between one side and the other. It's almost like the old cartoons where they had the angel and the devil on your shoulder, and it's like pulling you between two different, you know, ways of thinking, right?
Yes, right.
And that's the way I've always thought of it anyways.
Well, I'm with you very much. The angel and the devil are both on our shoulders. We're both made of stuff, angel dust and devil dirt. Both part of us. And unfortunately, tragically, war brings out the devil. It has to. And so what you and I are sharing with our listeners is really that moral injury is inevitable in warfare, even in a good war, in a just war, even in one that we say is justified or purely for defense. We are taking life. We are destroying. And our religions do teach us we shouldn't.
That's right.
Buddhism teaches nonviolence. Mm-hmm. Won't even kill insects. But it doesn't say that killing another human being in war is wrong. Buddhism says it's tragically necessary sometimes to protect ourselves and our loved ones. That's different mm-hmm. than thou shalt not kill, but I did kill, and now I'm torn apart. And in fact, the Bible, the commandment in the Bible is that is not thou shalt not kill. It's thou shalt not murder.
That's right.
It's
very often misquoted in that sense. And so that's why I wanted to bring that up. And actually I was going to get to that, and I forgot to even bring that up as I was bringing up that point, but you're right. It is, you know, thou shalt not murder. And that's a different thing than, you know, fighting in war and, mm-hmm. you know, defending yourself, defending others, defending your country, those types of things. And there are examples even in the Bible of wars that took place and fighting that took place and people being killed. And so, yeah, but there's still that inner struggle, that inner conflict between, you know, what I did and what I've been taught to do mm-hmm. and all that. And so I'd like, go ahead.
I suggest that we would be preparing our troops much better for the experience, the military experience, if we taught them what moral injury is in the beginning during training, and if we taught them how difficult service was going to be, and you're going to have to do things that are going to tear your heart to shreds. We're teaching you how to kill. We also have to teach you that it really hurts to kill, and it should hurt to kill, and that you are going to come out with emotional and spiritual distress that mm-hmm. is going to bother you, and you're going to need to work hard to resolve it. So I translate, since we have the acronym PTSD, I translated it in two additional ways in addition to stress disorder. And apropos now, I also translate it as post-traumatic soul distress.
Okay.
Our physical and emotional and mental symptoms are the core of our being, our soul, expressing its anguish and trying to communicate what's bothering us when we don't have the words for it, or when we don't have helpers, or the society isn't recognizing it. So we're displaying it through our body. Our soul wounds come out through our behavior, through our body. So post-traumatic soul distress. I also define it as post-traumatic social disorder. Okay. And that's for a number of reasons. I talk about these extensively in some of my books, especially Warrior's Return. But social disorder, as you and I shared earlier, there isn't enough civilian understanding and support for the military. So when there's a profound break in comprehension, understanding, and support between the warriors and the people they're serving were in social disorder. Secondly, when we don't General Eisenhower said this at the end of World War II. He said the biggest mistake our country made was not providing the millions and millions and millions of dollars necessary for mental health treatment for all the returning World War II vets. They weren't okay. Instead, we gave them the GI Bill, which is actually a massive disability bill. You don't have to look inside your mind and your heart and see how you are. You got to put yourself together. We're going to help you buy your car and buy your mortgage and get along in life. And so that's what happened to many millions. Instead of looking inside to see what war had done to us, psychologically, sure. Spiritually.
But yeah, and it kind of was just kicking the can down the road, right? I mean, it didn't address the issue, and then that just funneled into the next conflict, and then the next conflict, and eventually we wisened up and we said, okay, we probably need to start doing something about this if we're going to keep getting into these wars.
I don't know about you, but it also funneled down into me and into the children of each generation, because we can quote the Bible again. The sins of the parents shall be visited upon the children unto the third and fourth generations. That's true about PTSD. It's definitely transgenerational, only it's not the third and fourth generation. It goes on and on and on through all the generations until somebody does serious healing work and ends it in themselves. So my father had severe PTSD, and he was emotionally and physically violent. So he sure taught me what PTSD is like.
Yeah. You know, and it's unfortunate, but it's true. That does happen. And it's not every single person who has PTSD is not like that, fortunately. But unfortunately, there are those people who do affect other people around them. And it kind of has this ripple effect where it's that one person is in the center of that ripple, and it kind of radiates out to, you know, immediate family members, right, and other folks who are in their life. And it is troubling, but I think we're doing some good work nowadays to help address some of this stuff, to allow those people to heal,
yes,
and not push that down on the next generation, which then continues for generations to come. Now, speaking of the things that we are doing to help folks with this, what are some of the things that you found are helpful for veterans healing from moral injury, who might come back with some sort of moral injury? What are you doing or seeing that works with them to help get over this type of thing?
Well, I'm going to be somewhat radical here.
Okay.
They have been leading healing and reconciliation journeys back to Vietnam beginning in 2000. I did that until the pandemic stopped it. So for 19 years, I led healing and reconciliation journeys back to Vietnam. And we met with the Vietnamese people. Every journey was different because I designed each one for the veterans who were going. So everybody wants to go back to their AO. Where are you, sir? Who I fought? Sometimes we were able to, we always met with Vietnamese veterans and had reconciliation groups. Always. We had art exchange groups. We had poetry reading where veterans read to each other's work. Regarding moral injury, our veterans want to know, I'm just talking about Vietnam now, but this is true about all wars. We want to know that the damage isn't forever, that people and the land are recovering. So veterans need to go back to see that the Vietnamese people on land are okay. They're good now. More importantly, they want to be with people that they fought against and people they harmed. So sometimes I was even able to find veterans from the same battle who fought against each other and have them in reconciliation groups. Regarding moral injury, our veterans suffer very much from the damage we did, what we left behind, and whatever they had to do to stay alive and to serve the mission. And this is true about all our wars, because our military is so technologically advanced and sophisticated. And the wars are always elsewhere, at least until very recently.
Sure.
So The damage is elsewhere. The death and destruction are elsewhere. And we don't see it here, though we see some of it in the media. So our veterans do feel like they have done quite extensive damage. And we don't only practice exchanging forgiveness, but also atonement. Mm-hmm. With our veterans, we built 2 schools in Vietnam. We've helped build Agent Orange treatment centers. Many of our veterans have adopted disabled Vietnamese children. We've, for a decade and still going on, we've been running a program for a destitute village in the Central Highlands, providing them with pregnant mother pigs. So that they can feed their family and also have an industry. And they'll never be able in their own lifetime to save up the $350 that a pig costs. They are so desperate. Mm-hmm. However, give them that and they'll be able to, it's enough to start a family industry and support the family ongoing into the future. So All of this is to say that we can address moral injury directly by addressing the harm we caused, the damage we've done, and practice atonement and give back, put the world back mm-hmm. together. Most of the English language comes from other languages, but the word atonement actually comes from English. It really means what it says, at one ment. War, however necessary sometimes, destroys the world and breaks it into pieces. It destroys oneness or one ment. And afterwards, we reverse the process by doing good for others. It doesn't have to be overseas where we fought, but what's really important is that we experience ourselves as positive forces contributing to the world in a positive way. So we'll know this. We'll tell our friends listening, veterans in huge numbers and very large proportion are our first responders. We look for continuity between military service and civilian service. So our police force, our fire departments, conservation squads are loaded with veterans who have skills that they learn from the military that are applicable in civilian service this way. So another way to heal from moral injury is to give service either as a volunteer or in some recognized capacity, but you have the skills for serving in danger and distress. You know how to do it. And you can go into dangerous settings where civilians will run away. So find a way to give it and to use it. Bless our veterans. This has happened in some of our horrible mass killings where in Florida and in Las Vegas, when the shooters were going after the kids and the concert goers, they were all running away. Veterans in the crowd turned around and ran toward the shooters to stop them and to protect the civilians.
Right.
And some of them died in Florida saving the children. We need warriors always. And we need warriors who are able to do this and to serve properly and still be willing to sacrifice themselves for the good of all. So there's so many ways to find to give and give back and experience yourself as a good person, not defined by tragic things you might have had to do in the war zone.
Right. And I think that's a key phrase that you just said there at the end there is things that you might have had to do. It might not have even been your choice. It might have been a situation where you were forced into, having to engage with a child maybe who might have been carrying a bomb or something like that, or even a rifle or something. And that could definitely affect the way you look at yourself. I know for me, I had a situation similar to that. And that for me, when I came home, I was like, that was kind of a lot different than what I thought I was as a person. I looked at myself more as a protector of, young, innocent children, and then you get a, you know, 10 or 11 year old kid who's, you know, holding a rifle, and it's like, okay, well, is that person even innocent anymore? And then there's that inner conflict that we were talking about before. And, and so it's difficult, and you have to, like you said, you have to try to, you know, work through that and kind of help figure out, you know, how you can continue with that. And, you know, it's not easy, but with some work and some practice and, you know, working with someone like yourself, you know, people can do that. You can find your way through that, but it's, you have to put in the effort and you put in the work to, in order to do it. It, you can't just sit there and let that fester and manifest in your head and continue to grow. And that thought gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And eventually it just gets so deep that it's like that hole you're never going to climb out of without a lot of help. So it gets really difficult when you don't address it and you just let it sit there and continue to grow in your mind. And, you know, some of these reconciliation and healing journeys that you're talking about going to Vietnam, you know, whether that's a possibility for folks who served in, you know, more recent conflicts, you know, maybe it is, maybe it's not. I don't really know, but that might be something that will help some folks if that's something that they're able to do, you know, in the future.
Right. I've taken some sandbox war veterans to Vietnam with me on these journeys.
Okay.
Oh, let me share. This is a good one. Good story.
Okay.
First time two Iraq combat veterans came to Vietnam with me. They wanted to be with Nam brothers. Your generation looks up to the Vietnam War generation, of course. You're our older brothers. Mm-hmm. You're in the, this is the legacy. We're following you. They wanted to be in Vietnam with their elder brothers. We had an amazing 2.5 weeks. We're in our closing circle, the last circle of the journey, and everybody's sharing, and our Iraq vet says to speak last. Everybody else shared. We got to them. They said, we've talked about this, so actually we both have the same message to all of you. What we learned is we're going home, and we're going to do our really difficult mental health work right away because we're not going to wait like you, we all waited. We don't want to look in 30 or 40 years, we don't want to look as effed up as you still are and it being so much pain. So thank you for what you did. Thank you for teaching us. And we really understand the consequences now, and we've got to work really hard on ourselves. So
yeah,
that's true. And that was real and that was good. Vietnam and going to Vietnam, many of our survivors and veterans of other wars would like to go back to where they served and wish they could. We can't go back to Iraq or Afghanistan now. We don't know if or when. Veterans for Peace is working in Iraq and doing a lot of restoration projects even now. And they actually began during the war. Mm-hmm. A lot of our troops practice atonement even while they're in service. I don't know about your experience, but oh my gosh, playing with the children, helping build schools, bringing over soccer balls and playing games. One really dear Afghanistan veteran friend of mine, beloved, he's my nephew by choice.
Okay.
We adopted each other. He stopped an atrocity. He saved children's lives when his unit wanted to waste them out of fear. Instead, he chased them, knowing he was risking his life. But he was a Marine. When his squad raised their guns, he just turned around and yelled, "Marines don't kill children. I'll catch them." And he did. He saved 4 innocent children so he doesn't have moral injury from that. Then he met the family. The whole family made friends. The family became friends with the Marine unit and were serving him. And he used to help them farming. And then when he came home, because I fit in Afghanistan, I don't fit into the United States of America anymore. So he bought a really raw piece of Wyoming land. And I learned goat farming in Afghanistan.
He's a goat farmer.
Okay.
That's also atonement in a way. I'm taking what I learned from the other people and I'm using it here as well. I can think of three Marines I know who served in Sandbox Wars who converted to Islam for
okay.
as their form of atonement and healing their moral injury. I went to war against this religion. I don't know if it was right or wrong. I want to find out what this religion is, and I want to support its survival in a positive way. And then so many people are in positive service. There's a tanker I worked with from Iraq, who had terrible moral injury and could hardly speak what he said, what he had done. Finally, it came out, and finally, the building he had to blow up to get to the snipers and all the families that he killed. And as he resolved that, bless him. And he was married, but he couldn't perform and they couldn't have children because he went frigid in the wart.
Okay.
From his tank. He had the biggest gun, so his gun didn't work. And we're smiling, but it's all symbolic. They're all connected psychologically. So he couldn't fire his gun anymore until he told the story and did significant resolution and atonement. And bless him, he became a very, very good social studies teacher because he knows the real thing. He knows how to teach history because he helped make it, lived it.
Sure.
And he and his wife reconciled, and they've got a beautiful baby boy.
Excellent.
So all this is just to tell our friends, yes, healing is possible. And every country doesn't have PTSD and moral injury the way we do, because it depends so much on how we're trained, what is the purpose of the war, whether it's aggressive or defensive. Another thing I learned in Vietnam, I researched this all over the country, hundreds and hundreds of interviews with Vietnamese veterans. They don't epidemic wartime PTSD like we do. There's very little in Vietnam for a lot of reasons, but a main reason is they were defenders, not aggressors. We're
sure.
only trying to protect our country and keep it unified. And their spiritual and religious background, Buddhist, Confucian, Animism, ancestor worship, that for thousands of years, it really creates a very peaceful people in general who can fight like the demon when they have to, but also stop immediately.
Sure.
Vietnamese veterans over there will say, this is a quote, "The war was over on April 30th, 1975. We were your friends on May 1st. Why did it take you so long to realize that?"
Right.
So also,
yeah, and that's a good point.
Not to hold on to anger and want vengeance, but
yeah,
let it down. A real warrior is in the war for the collective reasons of protection and preservation, not a personal reason for vengeance. And I hope I'm not hurting you saying that, because I know you lost your brother, and I don't know if hatred or rage or vengeance awakened in you at all, and it would be natural if it did.
Yeah, no, and don't worry about that as far as, I'm concerned or anything like that. It's of course there was some anger and that type of thing going on. And, like you said, that's, I think, a normal human reaction to these types of circumstances. But the thing that you were just talking about where, the next day they were friends, you were enemies one day, and then the next day they looked at it as we're friends. And then, we have our guys coming back home, and then it's not until decades later that they decide to do something to get some help. And they're carrying that anger and that rage and the all the negative emotions that surrounded the time that they had in war. And they're hanging on to that for decades. And then eventually they finally decide to do something with it. And at that point, it's so ingrained in them that it's really difficult at that point to start pulling yourself out of that. Whereas I believe it was the Iraq veteran that you mentioned who went with the guys to Vietnam, who said that they want to start working on this immediately, like right now. And that makes it a lot easier, I think, mm-hmm. to be able to heal from it when you're dealing with it right off the bat and not waiting so long, right?
Yes, that's true. And that was the philosophy. We don't have many, but our military did create critical incident teams. And the goal was get to our soldiers, our troops, as soon as possible, immediately after the incident, or as soon as possible, mm-hmm. because you're certainly right. In working with trauma, the sooner we get to the survivor after the trauma happened, the more accessible the emotions are, the less damage is done to the nervous system, the less time it has to eat its way, corrode its way into our body-mind system, and the more accessible we are to doing the healing work. So sooner is better. Also, the age in which it happens is also really important. And that's a challenge for us because we're taking people into the military at a young age. I mean, 18 and younger with permission or lying your way in. In Ukraine, in the last few months, Ukraine tragically, regrettably lowered their draft age to 25. This entire war, it had been 28. They were not sending young people because they know the damage is much worse. The younger we are in a trauma-creating environment, the more damage, because it becomes part of our development. And the brain is not a mature, the adult level of maturity, and stop this rapid growth until our mid-20s. So sending 18, 19-year-olds, no offense to us, but you're still kids. We're still kids. We're still, and we're putting the violent experiences, or even the military experiences, we're making that actually part of our child rearing and child development. So it's shaping our personalities in ways that doesn't happen if we're older and we have some resilience to trauma because the adult personality has coalesced.
Absolutely. I want to skip ahead to something else that we briefly touched on earlier in the conversation, but that's the role of whether it's families or the community around you or just, you know, the civilian population in general. How can those folks better support the veterans who are dealing with either moral injury or PTSD, combination of the two, or however that might look in the individuals? I know it's probably hard because they don't have the same understanding of what folks have gone through. They might just have the Hollywood version of what people have gone through in the military. And, you know, that might be the extent of it. And thank God it is. But, you know, is there things that, like, kind of on a broad scale that we can do as a society to help those folks who are dealing with moral injury and PTSD?
Sure. Yes, it's true that most Americans carry Hollywood versions of what military service and war is. Dear, one of my best friends in life, not a client, one of my best friends, real soul brother, his name was Willie. He had been a recon patrol sergeant in Vietnam. So he was through the worst of the worst. And he used to say, nobody learns what war is from a movie. If we want to teach moviegoers what war really is, well, you fill this theater, you have a blank screen in front of them, you have one combat troop with his M16 behind the screen, and just open fire for 30 seconds. Then people will know the real thing.
Yeah.
It's so much worse than anybody can ever imagine. And we need this, we need the civilian sector to know that. So I also, when I said that I redefined the acronym PTSD, in addition to soul distress, I also call it post-traumatic social disorder. Because of what we're sharing about the divorce between the civilian and the military, we need our civilians to be as involved as possible in every aspect of warrior return and recovery. Another great story that demonstrates this. I worked with a Native American woman who, from the West Coast. She was Coastal Salish. She was a combat nurse during the Korean War. And she was fine. Because this was her homecoming story. As she was flying home to Seattle Airport, as she got to Seattle and she looked down on the ground out of her window, she saw her whole tribe had arrived and they were down on the ground and they had made a human medicine circle, the Native American medicine wheel symbol, living medicine wheel on the ground with a whole tribe to welcome them her home. They landed. The whole tribe was there. She wanted to run up and hug everybody. They wouldn't let her. The tribe was back. The elders, the medicine men and medicine women, were in front. And they said, "Sister, you're home now. You're safe. Stop. You can't go home. We're taking you into the woods with us for 3 months to do all the ceremonies and rituals and teachings necessary to take the war out of you before we let you go home to the village, or else you'll bring the war home to all of us." So okay. There were elders. There was the entire community turning out for support. They understood how hurting she was. They were willing to wait for their reunion and not selfishly hug and grab, "Oh, you're home and I want to feel better." And the medicine people, the elder men and women, knew all of the ritual practices for purifying and cleansing her and restoring her soul. The Lakota people, what we call PTSD in their language, is called Nanginapeapi, and it means the spirits left. It's a spiritual there too. In the Native American traditions, their medicine people are the ones to restore the souls of the distressed warriors. And they have massive forms of practice that include time alone, a lot of rest time. Don't get back to work right away. Downtime, supported, safe downtime, intensive purification and cleansing practices. So sweat lodges, steam rooms, saunas, sweat it out. Storytelling, always. Don't keep your stories locked up to yourself. They'll turn into your nightmares. Right. It's really important to tell for other brothers and sisters and people who get it. It's really important to tell civilians. It's really important for the civilians to prepare themselves, ourselves, to be able to listen. I had secondary PTSD for a couple of years when I began working with veterans because I was exposed to so much traumatic war material that I had never heard, and I knew it was horrible, but not as horrible as some of the things I heard. So I had to be willing to feel pain, to be upset, to feel grief, to feel disgusted, to have nightmares for a while, and to allow myself exposure to that poison so that I could develop my own antibodies, so I could be non-judgmental and accepting and look at anything that our warriors needed to look at and needed me to look at with them and be non-judgmental about it all. Mm-hmm. And develop, you know, my own immune system so that I could look at the most horrible things and not look away and not judge anybody in a negative way and not break down myself. So it would be great to have civilian training programs for how to talk with our military and veterans and get our civilians ready to be together. And then eventually in programs together, talking circles that include civilians. So the veterans are telling the stories and the civilians are learning and witnessing and being exposed and gaining some degree of initiation themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. When you have that community come together, like some of the Native American folks that you were mentioning there, where they understand what the person might want, but also understands what the person might need. And right. Those two are not always the same thing. And, you know, you might want to go run back home to your family and to your normal day-to-day life that you left beforehand. Well, you're not always the same person that you were when you left. And so to just jump right back into the old routine that you were in before without doing anything to help yourself get back into that routine or any type of work at all on, you know, what you had gone through, might be doing yourself a disservice. And you might be in that space and then find yourself unable to operate in that environment without having gone through some sort of work, whether it's, you know, some of those rituals like you had just mentioned, whether it's, you know, going to talk to a mental health provider or, you know, even like a group therapy type thing where you're sharing your stories to, you know, either other veterans or civilians or other folks who maybe have gone through certain similar things. Nobody's gone through the exact same thing as you have gone through. And so, but you might have find somebody who has gone through something similar enough that they get what you're going through and you can share that with them and get that off your chest, if you will, and not let it just fester inside your head to the point where you feel like I can't tell anybody about this because this is such a shameful thing or it's such a terrible thing that I went through that or that I had to do or whatever. You want to get that off your chest sooner than later because then it doesn't have the opportunity to sink its hooks into you and not be able to let go, right?
Right. Underlining and emphasizing what you said about you might not be the same person when you come back. You won't be the same person when you come back.
Sure.
And neither will any of your family members be the same person when they come back. So
that's true.
Your spouse is different. What did your spouse go through during your deployment? Referring back to the tanker whose story I told earlier. Mm-hmm. So for a while, I had him and his wife in marriage counseling, and he didn't want to tell his stories, and she really wanted to know why he was hurting so much. So he finally blurted, "You really want me to tell you about the building I blew up and all the dead bodies I had to scrape off the roof?" She said, bless her. She said, "Yes, I really want to know, but on one condition." "You don't really want to know." "I really want to know. No, my condition is I will listen to all of your stories. If you listened to my story and how much fear and pain I was in during your entire deployment and how I was watching the news every night, seeing if they were reporting you dead. I had a hell of a year also. So we don't know each other anymore. So we've got to start again." And so let's make this marriage therapy into like a reacquaintance with the two people we've become now, and let's start dating each other and put it back together. That's what we have to do. Nobody is the same. And coming home is really hard. And difficulties of coming home, also a source of PTSD. And sometimes even worse, because we go to war, we know there are people out on the other side of the world who want to harm us. We come home and we expect our country to love and support and respect us and treat us well. And if we don't get that, that's profound betrayal. And that also contributes to a traumatic wound.
Absolutely. And like we were discussing before we started recording, the folks who came back from Vietnam especially had just a terrible homecoming. And a lot of them were, you know, treated terribly. They were, you know, spit on, they were called names, they were even assaulted and other things like that were just such terrible, you know, things that happened to them. And could you imagine being that person who went off and did all these things that maybe they didn't want to do, but they had to do, you know, that was their way of defending themselves and defending their other soldiers or Marines or whoever and doing the work that they had to do. And not that they wanted to, but they had to, and they came back and they're being treated like garbage for doing something that they didn't want to do in the first place, especially those who are drafted, who, you know, didn't enlist and want to go. A lot of people who were drafted, they were forced to go do something that, you know, perhaps they didn't even want to do in the first place. So it just leaves that, you know, just a bad impression on that individual when they're not treated well and not supported and not given the resources and stuff to be able to heal. And then they do start to feel like, oh, I can't share any of my experiences with anybody. Never mind, you know, telling their story to, you know, on a podcast like this or writing a book or anything. It's like, I can't even tell my spouse, you know, the person who I used to be able to share everything right. with, I can't even tell that person. And so they keep that all bottled up inside. And, you know, eventually that stuff needs some place to go. And if it doesn't have a place to go, then it just leads to, you know, worse and worse things down the line.
Everybody, imagine we're in a swimming pool and we're playing water soccer or basketball. What happens when you try to push a basketball underwater?
Pops right back up.
And the harder we push down,
the harder it comes back up.
Simply what happens with our emotions and our memories.
That's right. Yeah.
And so we have to work really hard to push them down, and we're making ourselves ill doing it. We need each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we need, and who said that? The first Greek tragedy writer who was a combat veteran said 2,500 years ago, the first casualty of war is truth.
Hmm.
So for all of us, let us not allow that to be the first casualty. We have to tell the truth about war, and who knows better than our warriors to teach us all what it really is.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that is, I think, a great way to kind of wrap this up. Before we do wrap up, though, is there any kind of last kind of closing message or anything that you have for the listeners?
Yes. Don't want to sound trite when I say thank you for your service, but we need our warriors. Thank you for being our warriors. Thank you for taking on all of the sacrifice and suffering and challenges that you have. And welcome home. And please, please know healing and homecoming are really possible, more than possible. You can even be all you can be. You can become, again, throw out the cliches. You can become the best version of yourself. Evolve yourself. You'll never be a civilian again. You can and you will be an honorable elder warrior. So evolve into that identity, and that will help us all.
Absolutely. Well, that is, I think, a great place to end it here. But thank you so much for coming on, sharing your experiences, sharing your insights into moral injury and PTSD and all that with us today. I really do appreciate the stuff that you've been doing for the veterans, and, you know, taking the time to come on the show is definitely part of that. So thank you so much for all that you do.
You're very welcome. Bless you. And thank you too. And keep driving on by and keep bringing the warrior wisdom back for all of us. You're doing a great job. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.